Michael Hawley has published over a dozen research articles in journals dedicated to the Whitechapel Murders Jack the Ripper mystery, namely Ripperologist, Whitechapel Society Journal, Casebook Examiner, and The Dagger, and published online articles for numerous websites. He was honored to lecture at the Jack the Ripper Conference in Baltimore, Maryland in April 2016 and Liverpool, England on September 23rd this year. Hawley will be appearing on the Jack the Ripper episode of The Legend Hunter on the Travel Channel in its 2018 season and is the author of The Ripper's Haunts with the top book reviewer and author Paul Begg. He's also the author of The Watchmaker Revelations, a mystery thriller fiction trilogy with the first, The Ripper's Hellbroth, being published in 2017. Hawley holds a master's degree in science and secondary science education at State University of New York, College of Buffalo, and a bachelor's degree in geology and geophysics at Michigan State University. He's a commander and naval aviator in the U.S. Navy, retired, and is currently enjoying a career as a secondary earth science and chemistry teacher. He resides with his wife and six children in Greater Buffalo, New York. It's great to have you with us at 1001 Heroes Podcast, and I think today we're going to solve the mystery of who Jack the Ripper really was. What's been keeping you busy lately, number one, and number two, we would love to hear your opinions and story on Jack the Ripper.
Well, it's great to be part of this. As you just made a comment about, 2 weeks ago, I was in Liverpool, England at the Jack the Ripper Conference doing a lecture on the recent discoveries that we made on Ripper suspect Francis Humbley in January 2017, and that it was really enjoyable because it kind of shocked a few people there. But previous to that, last year was the Baltimore lecture, and that's when my book, The Ripper's Haunts, came out, and that was a bunch of new discoveries in the last 2 years. And so then my next book, which is going to be published by the time my the Legend Hunter episode comes on next March, it's called, the book is called Jack the Ripper Suspects, Dr. Francis Tumbleby. And so this just yesterday, or just a couple days ago, I flew into Dublin, Ireland, and was interviewed for about 3 hours on this particular suspect. But it's a Jack the Ripper episode. The Legend Hunter is a series that's going to begin in March 2018. And the host, Dan Spain, what they're doing is they're going all around the world finding legends. They were just in the Congo. They were in Sumatra. Now they're in Ireland looking for some royal jewels. So it's really interesting, and Dan is so charismatic, so it was a very interesting conversation. But he had heard about the discoveries we had, so he wanted to ask a lot of questions, and so it went really well.
What we'd love to know is what you've got on Tumblety. You've spent years researching Francis Tumblety and his psychological profile. You guys have laid it out pretty clearly in terms that you believe that there's a high likelihood that he was Jack the Ripper. So we'd love to have you tell us that story of Tumblety and taking us right along the road with him right through London.
Okay, great. The first thing is, as a researcher, I will never say 100% case closed, because once you say case closed, your mind is just locked into one particular suspect, and now it's very difficult to get out of that cherry-picking process, the cognitive dissonance. In this case, the first thing I talked about is when we had two different experts looked at the records of the Ripper victims, a forensic pathologist, Dr. William Eckert, and a forensic scientist, criminal profiler, Dr. Brent Turvey. When they looked at the crime scenes and the victims, or the records of them, they did not see a sadistic or a sadosexual serial killing. What they saw was a non-sadistic offender, meaning the mutilations were after death. So it was not a sadistic kind of killing. They killed, and then they eviscerated in that case. And also what they saw, they did not see a sexual offense, because the attack was not in, let's say, the vagina. It was more attacking the womb, what makes a woman different than a man. So what they were What both of them see, and this was independent of both, was they saw a behavior of anger retaliatory, and then they also saw reassurance oriented. Anger retaliatory would be one example of that. That would be hatred of women. But the reassurance oriented is interesting because that elements of that would be such as collecting trophies and putting, let's say, your victims on display, and also humiliating the victims sexually, or like a sexuality kind of thing, and trying to instill fear into the public. So both of those saw that. And so when we looked at Frances Tumblety, we see a lot of things. One is, the very first time that we got word of Frances Tumblety was Stuart Evans in 1992 received a private letter, or a letter that was written in 1913 as a private letter from the chief inspector of the special branch in Scotland Yard. And at that time, what that chief inspector was doing, it was a private letter to a famous journalist at the time named Sims. And what he said was that this was the first time that someone, Stuart Evans, had heard that the suspect Frances Tumblety was named. And here it is. Little Child said that he was a very likely one. Here, Stuart Evans has been, from today, he's been researching the Jack the Ripper murders for about 50 years now. And it was a shock to him back then, so it was like 30 years of research, to even hear his name. Not just a minor suspect, here is Chief Inspector Little Child saying he's a very likely suspect. And so then Stuart Evans started researching for a couple years and wrote his book and discovered a lot of material. And so then after that, he stopped researching Frances Tumblety. Then others got involved with Frances Tumblety's research, but a lot to the negative. And so a lot of the books were written that he was likely not even a serious suspect. So when I got involved in around 2009, I actually saw the reverse. And it wasn't just because of my looking at the same evidence. Well, I did look at the same evidence, and I really saw Stuart Evans's research is more credible. So, but then I started researching, discovering a lot of things. I have a background in research, and so I just kind of started focusing on that and discovered more and more things, and all of it, every bit of it, pointed towards not only that Scotland Yard considered Frances Tumblety one of the key suspects at the peak of the murders, that he could very well be Jack the Ripper, especially the recent discoveries that we've had this year. And reports show that he was when he was here, he was a loner. And but when he got here, within 3 years, age 20, he started working for an alternative doctor. This was a French cures kind of doctor. Lispinard was the nickname of the guy, and his name was Reynolds. But he was working in his office. And so one of the things about the 1850 census showed that Frances Tumblety was literate. So he could read all this material, and he was an office boy. But soon after that, he started working for an Indian herb doctor, R.J. Lyons, that was in Rochester for a few years. And the reports, a nephew who was only 4 years his junior that lived in Rochester with him, said that he started leaving Rochester at the age of 20, about the age of 20. And what he was doing was he was basically traveling, maybe not with the doctors, but he would be going to different city and helping advertise them. But that was in 1850, but then by 1856, Frances Tumblety was on his own claiming to be a full-fledged Indian herb doctor in Canada, London, Canada. And so within 3 years, he was in Toronto. He made, in today's value, $1 million. He was a brilliant man. He was very good at getting advertising, and one of the things he would do the botanical medicines, and they called it Indian herb doctor, but there were a couple of botanical medicines. But at that time, allopathic medicine, which was the medicine with chemistry that the medical association recommended and the surgeons would use, that was kind of nasty at the time because they were still using mercury, mm-hmm. and they were still bloodletting. So it hurt a lot.
So there was a lot of mistrust among the public toward the doctor profession. So they would turn to his advertising for patent medicines that were from safe herbs. that were gained from local Indian tribes or whatever knowledge they had, right?
Right, and he and amongst others too, but they would claim that they could cure all, but one of the things it did was it made you feel good initially, and he would actually get a lot of great testimonials, and that's he would publish these testimonials that he was a par excellence. He was not really pushing Indian herb doctor medicines; he was pushing himself as the best Indian herb doctor ever. So when he did that, he was making money hand and fist, but at the same time, he was getting himself into trouble for a couple reasons. One is that he claimed he was a medical doctor. He would say MD all the time. And so in Canada, the medical association, the doctors, successfully kind of booted him out. So he would go into a city, and then he would get kicked out, basically. But he would travel and go. He went through Canada all the way to the East Coast. And at the same time, we had a record of him treating his... certain women, widows and maids, not all women, but widows and maids, poorly. Then he went to the East Coast, to St. John, Canada, or it wasn't Canada at the time, but the Newfoundland area, but St. John, that one of his patients died. So they were going to charge him with manslaughter. Before the court case went on, he sneaked out of the country and came to Boston. And then he started doing the same business throughout the United States, still making money hand and fist. In 1861, when the Civil War began, in July 18th, the Battle of Bull Run, the first Battle of Bull Run, we see Tumblety in Washington, D.C. He called it himself in his autobiography his two-year sojourn in D.C. What he did was he tried to convince the General McClellan at the time, that he was a qualified surgeon and he wanted to get on his staff. Now, he really didn't want to get on his staff, but what happens is, because he really did not have a medical diploma, if the U.S. Army has hired you as a surgeon, you've just bypassed a medical diploma. You are now an official surgeon, basically. He really wanted that, and so in the later years, he lied and claimed he was. But the general saw through him. But what he did was, back at that time, surgeons, to be the credible surgeons, all had anatomical museums to show that they created these anatomical models. And then so what he did was, it was reported by a man named Colonel Dunham that Tumblety invited officers, which would be the eyes and ears of the general, to have an illustrated lecture. And within that illustrated lecture, meaning he was talking about his surgical skills, he presented some of his anatomical specimens, and Colonel Dunham said his favorite was his collection of uterus specimens. And so some people had argued that that was the only person that said this, and we can't trust Colonel Dunham because he's got a shady past. But what I found out was, just a month before he had that illustrated lecture or claimed to, he was in New York City, and there was a New York reporter complaining about his office because he had pictures of anatomical specimens outside his office. 1880-1881, there is an absolute shift in his agenda. Prior to that, it was money-making. And part of that money-making was being in the limelight, trying to advertise, and wearing, you know, kind of being eccentric in his clothing, wearing five different suits in one day. But at 1881, that stopped. And so we have no record of advertising. He no longer had any offices in the United States or North America, but he continued to have offices in England. And then there's record of him having an office in London. They never advertised. And so what, in January of 1888, the year of the murders, he talked to a Toronto Globe reporter, and he told that reporter that he was in constant dread of sudden death because of kidney and heart disease.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And so what you see now with these new, the 700 pages of documents that he said that to multiple people throughout the 1880s and 1890s that he could die any moment, or you might live another 10 years, but he could drop any moment. So you could see that he shifted into quality of life. And now he would visit cities that improved his health, such as hot springs. So he really was into the hydrotherapy springs, Saratoga Springs in Northern, in New York. So he would try to go into these areas for his health. And so, but he absolutely blamed women for the curse of the land. And he did that. We have record of him doing that in Liverpool in the 1870s, and he continued to do that. And so here's a man that he didn't hate all women. He hated women, basically, who could decoy young men away from their intended lovers, and that would be men. Now, 1888, by the way, the murders, let's say October or September was a double event, then we have Mary Kelly. So here's when you look at the Ripper victims, the three organs that were taken was the kidney, the heart, and uterus twice. So Tony is the only one connected to those three organs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty interesting.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that they had a file on him at Special Branch. Now, Special Branch, if I'm understanding correctly, was set up by Scotland Yard really to monitor Irish national terrorist action. Is that correct? And
the
following question is, do you have anything that links Tumblety? They must have had it, but do you know what they had on Tumblety that linked him to the Irish National Terrorist Organization?
A couple things. One is, I don't believe that large dossier was in Special Branch. I believe it was in CID.
Okay.
So the reason why many people think that Special Branch is because Chief Inspector Littlechild was the one that made the comment. So if I could read that spot that he talks about that. Here's Littlechild talking privately to a person saying, I never heard of a Dr. D in connection with the Whitechapel murder. Dr. D, by the way, is Druitt, because mm-hmm. Sims, who was a journalist, believed Druitt was the murderer, thanks to McNaughton. But it says, but amongst the suspects. So here it is, amongst the suspects. Here's Chief Inspector Littlechild, who was not directly involved with the Ripper murders, but indirectly he was. Amongst the suspects means Tumblety was already a suspect when he got involved. He was a suspect by the investigative division, CID. And to my mind, a very likely one was a Dr. T. Sounds like T. He says he was an American quack named Tumblety and was at the time a frequent visitor to London, and on these occasions constantly brought under notice of police, there being a large dossier concerning him at Scotland Yard. So what happens is, as he continues, he talks about Tumblety, and he says that although a psychopathia sexualis subject, meaning gay, he was not known as a sadist. Then it says, which the murderer unquestionably was. That was part of Special Branch, which means Special Branch, as you said, they focused on the Irish nationalist issue, especially the violent branch of that, you know, like the Fenians. So they could care less about him having a hatred of women. But Tumblety was already, 1873, Tumblety was in front of the judge, got arrested in London because of his sexual assault relationship with a young man named Lyons. That would not have been Special Branch. That would have been mm-hmm. CID.
Right.
So he already had a file in CID. So then it says Tumblety was arrested at the time of the murders in connection with the unnatural offenses and charged at Marlborough Street, remanded on bail, jumped his bail, and got away to Boulogne. Now, the point there is he was exactly right. But then it says here, he shortly left Boulogne, which he did because he went to Havre, because Boulogne is how you get across. So usually he left England on the West Coast, Liverpool, when he went to New York. He sneaked the other way, got to Folkestone Harbor, and crossed the channel to Boulogne, which was how you did that with a ferry. And so then you'd take a train to Havre, France, and then you took the ship on November 24th. But it says it was believed he committed suicide, but certain it is that from this time, the Ripper murders came to an end. So when he says that certain it is that from this time, the Ripper murders came to an end, he's trying to tell Sims that this is one of the reasons why he's convinced that Tumblety should be taken seriously. But Littlechild although he was completely accurate, he was completely wrong when it says it was believed he committed suicide. Chief Inspector Littlechild's boss the next year was McNaughton, who was convinced that it was the Druitt who committed suicide. Mm. So you can see why Littlechild gets mixed up.
Yeah.
If Francis Tumblety was a serious Fenian suspect, the dynamiters in New York were a huge thing. Littlechild had direct knowledge of what was going on in New York because Chief Inspector Burns of New York City said in 1884 that he was in constant communication with Scotland Yard because of this stuff. And so Littlechild would have known exactly where Tumblety was afterwards, because if he was taken seriously as a Fenian, he would have known what was going on with Tumblety in 1888, 1889. But look at it. In this private letter, it says it doesn't say that. So my point would be is, yes, he was definitely taken under consideration because of the Irish nationalist issue, because he traveled back and forth, and he was a rich Irish American.
I'm hoping you can fill in a blank for me. One of the subjects I didn't cover in our two-episode series on Jack the Ripper was the 22 Batty Street Lodger.
Okay.
Could you explain what that part of the mystery was and why you think it was Tumblety?
Well, that came from Stuart Evans. When what happened was that right after the double event murders, Berner Street was where Elizabeth Stride was murdered, so the double event. And so Batty Street is pretty much right next to Berner Street. And so what happened was there was a right that evening after the double event, at 2 in the morning, a tenant came into, I think it was 19 Batty Street, that came in, and then that next morning, the lady heard that him come in at 2 in the morning. So then the next morning, the man had wrapped clothes and said, could you wash these and I'll get these later. And so she noticed that the cuffs had blood splattered all over them. And so that was so threatening enough, especially when she got word that, you know, here's Jack Ripper kind of attacking again, or these murders, that the police got involved real quickly. And so apparently then it gets cloudy, because we have different reports, and there is, in the case, we have conflicting reports. One of the reasons I believe is that Scotland Yard did, and they were told not to talk to the press. And so in this case, a neighbor made a comment that, so the woman would stop talking. So you could see that Scotland Yard got a hold of the woman to say, don't talk to the press. So, but a neighbor did and made comments that she said something to the effect about this foreigner that the person was, the lodger was. So then what happened was, between 1900 and 1910, it was probably maybe 1908, 1907, what happened was this very same journalist that Littlechild wrote a letter to, Sims, wrote an article about some recent events about who possibly Jack the Ripper was, because at the time, Sims was quite convinced that it was Druitt, made some comments about Druitt, but he also made a comment that some stuff happened in the paper about Jack the Ripper. This lady came up to him and said that she had Jack the Ripper staying at her place, and made a comment that it was an American that had the blood on here and on the cuffs. And what she said was that she saw him again in London somewhere, American doctor, that's what she said. It was an American doctor. And so she was convinced that person was him. And so I think what happened was that Sims contacted Scotland Yard and they investigated. But what's interesting was that 1888 to about 20 years later, this lady says that she's convinced she sees somebody. Important was that she said that she had Jack the Ripper staying at her place. So if the police back in 1888 with the Batty Street Lodger said that that was nothing and she was convinced, why then 20 years later she's so convinced that Jack the Ripper was really there?
Mm-hmm.
And so this right here, The timing is quite interesting about that. And so that right there, because of the American Doctor connection, it's not that we're convinced that that was Francis Humbley, but there it does show that there's a possibility.
Now, there's another American Doctor connection, and that was the report to the police that an American doctor apparently was asking, was it medical colleges or museum, for uteri, that he was trying to buy them in 1888, and that it was an American doctor from, they said, Philadelphia. Could you fill us in on that story?
Oh, okay. It was Baxter, actually, he was the coroner that went after the Chapman murder. Baxter said that he got word that there was part of the two different medical schools. Supposedly an American doctor, American medical student, approached them and asked for a collection of uteruses for, I think, 20 pounds apiece or something to that effect. And so what Baxter was trying to say is not that that particular person was Jack the Ripper, but what, if you read the reports, he was saying possibly what was happening was that the person that took that uterus from Chapman was looking for that, and maybe trying to sell that, you know, part of the business of selling. So what happened was then, soon after that, there was a report that that particular doctor was identified. It was a gynecologist in Philadelphia that was there the year before, and he was not a medical student. He was a well-established older gentleman looking for some specimens. And so the interesting thing about that was that here again Sims makes a comment a couple decades later that there were still people in Scotland Yard that are convinced that Jack the Ripper was looking for uterus specimens in the almost living bodies, meaning he just got killed. So why, if it was true that they were convinced, if Scotland Yard was convinced that Philadelphia gynecologist was the person that was trying to get those uterus specimens, why then here Sims, who had connections with Scotland Yard, 15 years later, makes a comment that people in Scotland Yard are still convinced about that story? Wouldn't it, to me, if it was absolutely that gynecologist, that's kind of, a slam dunk. It was not anyone. But, so to me, that's why we can see that there's still more to that story.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
There was a theory back then that Scotland Yard actually investigated that Jack the Ripper was looking for the elixir of life, and he was mixing herbs with the fluids of the uterus where life begins and trying to make this elixir. So here we know Francis Humbley knew that allopathic medicine wasn't working for him, knew that his botanical medicine wasn't working for him, and it was at a time that actually people were looking for the elixir life science. Even in 1888 to 1889, a French doctor named Brown Sicard was claiming that he had powdered pig testicles, that when he ingested those, he felt just tremendous vigor. So there was a scientific search for an elixir of health, elixir of life at the time. So it wasn't just kind of like one of those bizarre things that was happening. And incidentally, at the same time the Ripper murders were occurring in the wealthy West End of London and the Lyceum Theater, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was being played, and the reporter said that the Scotland Yard was saying it was a Jekyll Hyde kind of theory, because here it is, this man's looking for this elixir, and that's what happens with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Lo and behold, in that Lyceum Theater at the time, we have Bram Stoker, author of Dracula, is the business manager. His best friend was Sir Henry Hall Caine, who was the boyfriend years earlier to Francis Humbley.
Right.
And then, in Lyceum Theater, the people that worked there, they were members of this Masonic group called the Order of the Golden Dawn, and their primary goal was work for the Elixir of Life. So it's kind of all these really kind of close correlations with this stuff. But
yeah, it's all tied in. I did an episode on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and that book that she wrote in 1818 was inspired by a legend that she had heard of as she traveled up through Germany and passed a castle called Frankenstein Castle. And that was inhabited by a mad doctor who was seeking, guess what, the elixir of life. So this is 1818, so yeah. this theory kept doctors' minds busy, I know, throughout the 19th century. And no doubt caused a lot of havoc.
Well, as a matter of fact, what Francis Tumbley did was December 2nd, 1888, he arrived in New York, and in January 31st, 1889, he gave an interview to a New York World reporter, admitting that he was in the in the Whitechapel district during the murders. He said. And that he blamed the British police for arresting him because they were basically idiots. Well, within 2 weeks of that interview, he had his 1889 autobiography published, which was basically his 1872 autobiography, but there was a chapter that he was countering the Ripper fiasco, and he did not want to connect. He never says London. He talks about his name being spread all over the papers, and instead of blaming the British press, he blames the New York papers. And why he does that is because he doesn't want any connection to London, but he's blaming them. So within the 1866, 1872, and 1889 autobiography, he talks about somewhere out there is this, in the botanical world, there is this elixir of health that can cure all that he's in the search for. So then, lo and behold, in the 1893 autobiography, he makes a comment that there is not the elixir of life out there. So it's like he gave up. And around 1893 is when you could see that he just gave up on this, and he just kind of lived as a homeless person on the outskirts. But how interesting that the 1890, he purposely made a comment about nothing like that in the 1893 autobiography. So more coincidence.
All right. Using circumstantial evidence, this is your last chance to talk to the jury. And I want you to bring up the five reasons you think are the top reasons why they should convict Tumulty for the Ripper murders.
Well, one of the things is as I said, I'm a researcher of Tumulty first, and although I have high suspicions, I will never say 100% just because I want to try to maintain as least bias as I can, although, you know, humans are naturally biased. But let me kind of make a couple comments. First of all, he is the only suspect that three Scotland Yard officials considered him a suspect even after the Kelly murders. We have Assistant Commissioner Anderson himself contacting U.S. Chiefs of Police around November 20th, asking for all information on Francis Tumbley, and it's basically when he talked to the Brooklyn police chief of police, he talked about in reference to the Ripper murders. This is January 20th. So then we have, of course, Chief Inspector Littlechild later on saying he's a very likely suspect, and this is after the Kelly murder. And then the last one is Inspector Andrews, which a different inspector who became a chief inspector, Walter Dew, made a comment that the three first-class inspectors involved with the Jack the Ripper murders at the time was Inspector Moore, Inspector Aveline, and Inspector Andrews. So nobody knew that at the time, I mean, besides this, but here's Inspector Andrews, that he went to Canada, coincidentally, around the same time in early December, and so there was some possible suggestion that he may have gone there to kind of hunt stuff down for the latest suspect they had was Francis Tumbley. So what happened was, I'm not going to argue that case, but what I'm going to say is, when he was in Toronto, there was a Toronto reporter asked him about Francis Tumbley. And so here's Inspector Andrews saying, always asked if you knew Francis, the Ripper suspect Francis Humbley, and Andrew said, of course I do. Now, he did say he's not the murderer, but of course he said that because here's Scotland Yard, kind of embarrassed that Francis Humbley sneaked out of the country. Of course he's going to say that. But what he said was, but all the same, we still want to interview him. How strange that is, that they still want to interview him. And but one of the things was he was actually arrested in November 7th, when you look at the court calendar records, he was placed in the custody, not for the Ripper murders at that time, but he was placed in custody for the gross indecency. What happened was he was arrested before that on suspicion of the Whitechapel crimes, and in his pocket were a number of letters from young men. So nobody saw the murders, by the way, and so there was no way that they're going to prosecute anybody for the murders unless they could get a confession, and Tumbley wasn't going to do that. So what they did was is they thought, well, they were convinced that here's an American doctor, and they were suspicious about American doctors thanks to the Dear Boss letter, because there was Americanisms in that Dear Boss letter, and that he was wearing an American slouch hat, that was part of one of the possible eyewitness accounts of an American slouch hat. And so when he was arrested, they said, well, if we could put him away for a couple years for gross indecency because we have him because of these art letters, and so if the murder stopped, then it looks like we might have our man kind of thing. That was their idea. But what happened was is when they arrested him a couple of days before Kelly murder, he posted bail. And even though there's no direct evidence to show that, when you go in front of the magistrate, you go into what they call a remand hearing. So to see if you stay in jail, in prison, Holloway Prison, until your committal hearing, which was November 14th, the judge or the magistrate gave him bail. So if you gave him bail on the committal hearing, you probably gave him bail on the remand hearing. And so what happened was is he posted bail by November 16th. Now what happened was is there was a grand jury. Now the Central Criminal Court case was going to be November 20th in front of the judge. November 19th was the grand jury case where now a jury appears is listening to the case. What happened was they gave it a true bill, meaning there was enough evidence to prosecute, at least to take it up to the judge. So Tumbley's lawyer knew right then that he was going to jail. I mean, they were convinced enough about that. So what happened? On November 20th, Tumbley's attorney successfully postponed that court case to December 10th. So it was now December 10th, and at the same day, Tumbley takes about over 300 pounds of cash from his New York bank, and likely to help escape. And what happened is by November 23rd, we see November 24th, he's on the ship in Havre. So November 23rd, he was in Boulogne. So between November 20th and November 23rd is when he escaped. And then, but what's interesting is Little Child himself said that he was seen in Boulogne basically on November 23rd. Well, what happens is that gross indecency case was legally postponed till December 10th. And so on December 10th, when he was a no-show, that's when there was a warrant out for his arrest. Why would Scotland Yard, if they were only concerned with Tumbley because of the gross indecency case, why would they know that he was in France on November 23rd? Because he was, just like the reports were saying back then, he was arrested, and their suspicion was because he might be Jack Ripper, and they were just trying to hold him because of the gross indecency case. So that's what was going on. And so we have three Scotland Yard officials making reference to that. And then the other thing is that he does match what these experts talk about, the anger retaliatory, and also reassurance oriented. And now what I already talked about is, if you look at the organs taken, let's say the canonical five, let's assume that Mary Kelly was, and by the way, I don't know who discussed it, but I have some conversation about Mary Kelly that I don't care, I don't mind if people don't think so, but there's actually good reason why she was, because there's a difference between M.O. and offender signature. And so the M.O. is clear with the first couple, but the offender signature, you see it quite a bit in Mary Kelly with reassurance oriented. But it doesn't matter because but we have the uterus, the kidney, and the heart, and that's the only suspect connected to those. But then there was this there's only one inanimate object taken from these victims. Regardless if we're going to talk about Kelly or not, but the other victims, there's only one inanimate object. And that was the wedding ring and the keeper ring of Annie Chapman. And so one of the things about Francis Tumbley was when he would get arrested for his sodomy and indecent assault with young men, and he would show in his pocket he had a whole bunch of expensive jewelry, and that he had cash in the other. He never mixed the two. He'd have to have cash on one side and jewelry in the other, and he would show that so that the police would treat him more like an upper, higher status person. So and that's why he would do that. And then, so we have record a couple times of what he had in his pockets. And so it was really just basically expensive diamonds. So when they itemized the list of jewelry on his, after his death, there was these imitation set rings, which could clearly have been that the keeper ring and the wedding ring. So it was kind of a surprise that Tumbley would have these cheap rings in his pocket, which kind of conflict with the purpose of why he had those in the first place, and they were never reported before. So they could very well have been those rings. But more importantly is that if you look at all those Ripper victims, nobody knows why Jack the Ripper took those rings, and if it was because of a trophy thing, why did he not take trophies from anybody else? Well, if Francis Tumbley was Jack the Ripper, there's an absolute reason why he took those, because Francis Tumbley hated male and female union. He hated heterosexuality. He blamed the women for this. And so that was the, if you look at any object on these women, that was the only thing that was a symbol of male and female union right there. And the last one is, I think is probably the most dramatic, is that a young man named Richard Norris, he was interviewed in 1905, there were 47 different interviews sworn testimonies and depositions for the court case for Tumbley's money, because two-thirds of the relatives of Tumbley never got a dime from Tumbley in the 1903 will, so they sued. They tried to claim that Francis Tumbley was not of sound mind and body in 1903, therefore his will is null and void, therefore the family members get equal amounts. That's what they were trying to do. Well, the attorney and the judge really could care less about his life except those last 2 years. So those interviews, was focused on between 1900 and 1903. But they also had lots of interviews about people that knew him since 1880, 1881, and they wanted to show a pattern of behavior. They knew that he was very eccentric, but they wanted to see what happened, what changed in the last 2 years. If they could prove that his personality changed completely or something weird, then he was senile, and that's what they were trying to do. It didn't work, but it showed that he was eccentric all the way. But young Norris admitted in 1881 that Tumbley, like he always did so many times, he picked young Norris up. Norris was 19 at the time, 1881, and Norris asked, Tumbley saw him at the St. Charles Theater in New Orleans and asked him if he could write a letter for him. So he brought him up, so he said yes and brought him up to the room. So Norris is explaining what happened. In 1881, Tumbley was there for a couple months. First, he was in the St. Charles Hotel. And so in there, I want to kind of read what Norris said. He said he saw a large tray, a trunk. Tumbley had a large trunk. And he said, then there was this sort of tray in the trunk. And there were all sorts of large knives in there, surgical instruments. And so what he's talking about is Tumbley was showing him his collection of surgical knives. Now, this is 1881. This is the 1880s. So then he goes, so what happened was Norris was smoking a cigarette at the time, and we knew that Tumbley was a big cigar smoker. So he said, Norris says, there were large knives in the trunk. Then he came over to me and felt my pulse and felt my legs. He says, I was smoking a cigarette at the time, and he said, throw that away. And he handed me a cigar, saying it was bad smoke cigarettes. He said, the trouble with young men are those cigarettes and those confounded streetwalkers. He said, if he had his way, they would all be disemboweled. This was 1881. Now, the interview was 1905. So some question is, well, is the guy telling the truth? Well, this person, Richard Norris, was the telegraph operator for the chief of police for New Orleans for decades. And as a telegraph operator, you're handling classified information. And he and his brother, by the way, had awards. They were well-respected in the New Orleans Police Department. And this is 1881. 1894-95. Now, here's Norris. What happened was is then Tumbly molested Norris a bit. So he talks about Tumbly being a hermaphrodite and all that kind of business and having this habit of killing women, he'd say. But he said that from 1881, every year, this is Mardi Gras season. During Mardi Gras season, which was January to March, it varied. But in New Orleans, he met up with Tumbly for 20 years. Now, that's till 1901, 1902. 1889, or 1885, Norris got married, and he has kids by the time. So here's a man that has to admit that he talks about later on how he admitted that he would take money for, you know, male prostitution, basically. And so, and that's what he knew that Tumbly, you know, had the liking for him. So he says, I don't do that thing unless I get money. So he's admitting that he's doing that with Tumbly and that Tumbly had the hots for him. And so he is now working in the police department, having a wife and kid, having to admit that he was doing this. So this wasn't something that we just kind of like lie about in a way. So the intriguing thing is this is the very first time we have any of the suspects are making a very Ripper-like comment. Now, one suggestion was that that when you read this, that Norris was trying to say that this event occurred just after the murders in 1889. Well, later on, the attorney asked, when did these events happen? And he said 1881. Or he said 1880 or 1881, but we know that Tumbly was in Europe in 1880 and during the Mardi Gras season, so it couldn't have been that. So it was 1881. But this rate, even if, let's say that was true, you're seeing that trunk is a travel trunk. Tumbly had surgical knives from 1881 to 1889. He's traveling with them. And half the, and everybody, you know, the reports show that half the year throughout the 1880s, he was in London. So with that trunk. So how intriguing is that?
Yeah,
so,
that puts him there with the weapons, no doubt about it.
And here's the interesting thing was, is when I wrote The Ripper's Haunts, we didn't know about this. And then when, you know, we had Paul Begg, who's the top book reviewer. He's got dozens of books. He, when he had read my book, he said that, you know, we have to take Francis Tumbly seriously now. Paul Begg is a serious reviewer. If you've ever seen any of his book reviews, he's straightforward. I mean, if the facts don't fit, he lets you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was because it's laden with facts. And then lo and behold, this comes up. You know, so it's like, to be honest, what happened was is when I found out that that Francis Tumbly was buried an hour and a half away from my house, that's why I wanted to first focus on this. This was kind of a, you know, like, who's Jack the Ripper kind of stuff, CSI stuff. Well, I was going to focus on Tumbly first. When I'm done with him, I was going to go to Druitt, because I was kind of curious about Druitt. Then I was going to be curious about, you know, just kind of go through the suspects and see what I could find, because I just love research. I just keep on finding more and more stuff on this guy. So, so basically, we're not done.
Well, it's ongoing. I do understand that. It's been fantastic having you on with us. You've been a great guest. I'd like you to just quickly recap your Travel Channel experience and when that's going to be airing. And then after you've done that, please tell us when your new book is coming out, what the title is, and give us a brief on that. And then how our fans can get in touch with you.
Oh, and by the way, there's a question you asked me for your fans, too. They can help out. Francis Tumbly, he was in basically almost every city in the United States getting in trouble. So if you want to go into any of the archives and find anything arrested, you could find something on Francis Tumbly, by the way.
Great. How do you access the archives in your city? What's the best way to get in those old newspaper articles? How do you do it?
I think you would probably go to either a library or, it just depends. Sometimes you have to go to local historical organizations there, and then they can actually really direct you in the right spot.
Name some cities both in the U.S. and in Central America and in Europe where people could look.
Okay, well, that was the other surprise, that he visited Mexico. And then he likely traveled to Mexico. He loved trains, but Mexico didn't have too many access that well. So, but from New Orleans, you could take a ship to the harbor, the cities on the coastline. And a couple of them actually were notorious for homosexual activity. So you can see why Tumbly would like to go there. And later on in life, he would frequent Hot Springs, Arkansas. He would frequent, Chicago, by the way. If anybody's in Chicago, you better look there because there's some stuff. He hated Chicagoans for a reason, because he got in trouble. Something happened. He still hasn't found that. So if you want to go there, that'd be great. So then, of course, New York City. And then he was in Pittsburgh. He was in Philadelphia. He was in Washington, D.C. He went to Alameda, California, or even San Francisco. He was in that area. He was in Baltimore. He had attorneys in Baltimore as well. And then Saratoga Springs. And then Toronto. He had, there's a lot of information on Toronto. He was even in Toronto in the year of the murders. And the problem was he couldn't go back to Toronto because Toronto or Canada was still kind of part of the British government. So if he went there, they could have easily extradited him for that misdemeanor offense, which they could not do in the United States. So he stuck with the United States after the murders occurred, and then possibly went into Central America. Maybe, there is hints that he went to Central America, but definitely the young man said that. He said, come to me to Mexico. But then, so those are some of the cities, and then probably any of the other cities, because he really did frequent, he loved cities. He was a city person. He loved to frequent the slums.
And what would some of his last names be if you were searching? If it wasn't Tumblety, what were some of the aliases that he used most often?
Okay, one of the things is that Tumblety, by the way, that name is a brand name, kind of like Trump is a brand name. So Francis J. Tumblety is what he used, and so at the end of his life, that's what he did. But there's evidence that it wasn't Tumblety spelled that way. Because on his in Rochester, on his family gravestone, it's Tumblety without a B. It's with a U in there too. And his mother and father are on there. His brother Lawrence is there. All of it says rest in may he rest in peace. And here's lo and behold, we have Francis Tumblety at the bottom here, and it does not say may he rest in peace. He used the name Smith a couple times. Now he used. Here's another interesting thing. He used Frank Townsend.
Yeah.
Only twice. When he sneaked away out of England in 1888, he used Frank Townsend, and when on his deathbed, or when he sneaked into 1903 when he went in there. And by the way, the 1901 will that he had, will and testament, was considered still valid, real, and in there he bequeathed $1,000, which is $10,000-plus today, to the Home for the Fallen Women. This is the type of women he hated worse, but he did it. Why? Because he was Catholic. And back then, he believed, like a lot of them at the time, which is not part of Catholic doctrine, but he believed this, that he wanted to grease the skids of heaven. So, so that's the owner. He didn't feel guilty about anybody. So, but, yeah, so then what happened was is just a couple days ago, I was flown to Dublin, Ireland, and we spent 3 hours interviewing pretty much what you're talking about. What happened was is the producers of the Legend Hunter went to England, London, and they asked if there was any new and surprising information. So what they said was, you got to talk to this guy named Holly. So then next thing you know, the producer was talking to me, and then I got a ticket to go there. And so we talked about very similar stuff. Now, and so I kind of presented that. Some kind of different kind of questions, but it was really enjoyable, and I did enjoy shocking them with a few things. So, but they were so excited about that, their little episode on this, that it's a Legend Hunter. So they've gone to a bunch of different places I was telling you earlier, and they think that this episode is going to be the best one, so they're going to do it first.
That's great. So look for Travel Channel, The Legend Hunters. And it's 2018, so is that January 2018 or
no?
Or?
They said that their episodes start in March.
Okay, March
2018, and then
So our fans can look for you there. How about your upcoming book? What do you have?
Right, and then Sunbury Press is the publishers, and then they will have this book. It's called Jack the Ripper Suspect, Dr. Francis Humbley. I wanted it straightforward. This is what it is.
It's right on it.
So if you're looking for that, that's what you're going to get. And it's got, I just scratched the surface. I'm telling you, there is an unbelievable amount of information. What I did is I go through his entire life to show what type of person he was, what was going on, when he was kind of cruel to widow or maid. Even in his autobiography, he talks about bragging about 1866 autobiography about bragging about being threatening to widow or maid, and surprisingly, that's taken out by 1872.
How do our fans contact you if they can find information?
Oh, probably the best way, I do have some Facebook pages, but I have my website, which is michaellhawley.com. So the a letter L in the middle for my middle initial is my website. I do have a website email that I look at, you know, every so often. I have a Facebook page called The Watchmaker. And the reason why it's called The Watchmaker is because my fiction series is, that's the protagonist, the hero. And the very first book is called The Ripper's Hellbuck, which is being republished like today. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be out. And it's basically a fictional version of The Ripper's Haunts, which was the nonfiction that I lectured last year.
And fans, that's Michael Hawley. Hawley spelled Hawley. Michael, thank you so much. It's been great having you as a guest, and I want you to get in touch with me as soon as any good information turns up involving the Ripper case.
I will. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and we'll look forward to staying in touch.
Great.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us at 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. We enjoy your reviews at Apple iTunes Podcasts very much, and would like to remind you that November is New Subscriber Month for us, so please help a friend subscribe to our show. Apple users or Android, it's all good, and we appreciate your loyalty as fans. Stay tuned in the weeks ahead for more exciting shows on a wide variety of topics, and check in with us at facebook.com/1001heroes whenever you can. Coming up next week, American Ripper, the story of H.H. Monroe. And the entire show will feature an interview with Jeff Mudgett, great-great-grandson of H.H. Monroe, the American Ripper. And some reviews. Always Interesting by Sventinavia, 5 stars. Great to hear parts of history uncovered. Great History by Candy Traveler 16, 5 stars. This is a great podcast if you're a history buff. I was so excited to find the episode about the Culper spy ring. It was a great listen. This is a great podcast by T3000. Rating 5 stars, one of the best podcasts out there. A Great Look at History by Moishiro, 5 stars. Thank you all so very, very, very much, and keep sending those reviews. We appreciate them. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn, and this is our story.